So 16 hours, you're gonna make sure your pack's full of water, full of food, full of tools you need for the job. After that, you're gonna get to work.
A firefighter talks about battling the sockeye blaze from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 19th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Alaska veterans have trouble accessing health care outside the VA system.
This is a threat to a collaborative effort that has been built over a period of years that has been very beneficial for our veterans.
All that tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The sockeye fire near Willow is 5% contained. Fire Information Officer Sarah Sarlo says the progress is made at the northern portion of the perimeter, but a recent wind shift could change that. Sarlo says the wind is from the south pushing north with gusts of 20 miles an hour, and that could test the gains made by firefighters. Almost 600 firefighters remain on the job for just such a possibility, and they will stay on the sockeye fire for at least two more days. Officials lifted the evacuation order earlier today over parts of Willow where threats from the sockeye fire have lessened. As firefighters chip away at the blaze, KSKA Zachariah Hughes spoke with the frontline responders that have worked around the clock since its rapid spread last week.
Yeah, this is what's called a one-mile hose lay kit.
Ken Cruikshanks points at piles of coiled hoses sealed on a pallet, pre-packed to stretch a mile if need be. It's one of the many spilling out of two tractor trailers in the Houston High School parking lot, staging ground for fighting the sockeye fire 20 miles up the road in Willow.
So we got about half the job done here.
This is the supply closet for the firefight, and Cruikshanks' job is dealing with the logistics that get hoses from storage depots in Palmer and Fairbanks to firefighters on the front line.
We can put out a lot of hose in one day, miles and miles of it.
There's also stacks of water bottles, pop-up tents, and fireproof pants and smocks that everyone's wearing. The reason for so many hoses, more than usual, Cruikshanks says, is because of all the homes that are near the blaze. Crews string hose lines down driveways as a last line of defense protecting structures. And while there's no shortage of hoses, there have been some issues getting enough of the water pumps called Mark III's, the workhorse of wildland firefighting. They look like oversized standing mixers, but weigh 55 pounds each and get tossed out of helicopters. Cruikshanks says that each year, Alaska has to call up about 200 of them from a depot in the lower 48.
We've never had enough here. And that's primarily because there's just not enough space to put everything here. We don't have the budgets to have huge, huge warehouses.
If Cruikshanks is managing the rear guard, then Josh Lutzinger is in the trenches.
The best way I've heard it termed is we're kind of fighting it from the inside out.
Like many of the guys shoveling down food in the high school cafeteria, Lutzinger has streaks of soot on his hands, face, and in his unruly beard. He's in charge of the Glacier Gannet crew, one of the elite groups of full-time wildfire fighters, or wild firefighters. It's unclear. He shows me a map of where his team has worked the last 5 days staunching the fire on its northern flank.
We're making sure that fuels are removed around people's homes. We're cutting fire line and obviously responding to the structures that were around there that were catching embers and stuff throughout the day as the trees torched up.
Why does it say explosives there?
Because there's a lot of explosives there.
Those belong to a company in charge of a nearby gravel pit, and Lutzinger's team has to be extra careful near the cache. Gannett Glacier is just one of 26 crews working on the sockeye fire, which has cost the state about $1.5 million so far. A lot of that money goes to paying for man hours.
So 16 hours, wake up, eat breakfast, make sure you're ready to go work hard all day. You're going to make sure your pack's full of water, full of food, full of tools you need for the job. After that, you're going to get to work, and then when you get back, you're eating dinner, going to bed, so you can do it all again the next day for the next couple weeks.
Fighting wildfires is expensive, and one of the challenges for officials is getting taxpayers to see all the effort that goes on behind the scenes, whether it's warehouse space for hoses or training courses for crews. This year, legislators cut 6% of the preparedness budget that handles wildfires, and that means that 16 positions in Southwest Alaska will be cut on July 1st. Tom Kurth oversees the state's fire program and says one of the biggest things working against them is the calendar.
By the time the legislative season comes around, January 15th, there's no smoke in the air. Wildland fire issues are at a minimum, and so reminding people of the activity that we have and what we represent is oftentimes a difficult proposal.
It's an issue that Lutzinger feels strongly about as well. A big part of why he's come back the last 15 years is the camaraderie that comes with working side by side, hour after hour, with the same 20 people.
You know, we've volunteered hundreds of hours this year. The guys believe in our program. I believe in our program. So that's probably one of the best parts of my job. There's so many I'd sit here yakking your ear off all day. I love my job a lot.
I guess like the flip side then is what's the worst or the hardest part of your job?
Dude, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. I haven't thought about that in a while. I try not to think about the bad stuff, I guess. So I don't know. Maybe when you got pack rash?
Crews have been lucky the last few days, but Lutzinger says they're mindful that the winds are switching course and conditions could quickly change. At last count, the fire destroyed 26 homes. Officials with the Matsu Borough are scheduled to begin more comprehensive damage assessments in the week ahead. In Houston, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Card Street fire near Sterling is still officially tabbed at 0% contained, but most evacuation notices have been lifted. The Kenai Peninsula Borough made a local disaster declaration Thursday night to get help with relief efforts. As KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, the fire continues to push away from homes and into the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge.
After 4 days of growth, the estimated size of the Card Street fire is now down to 7,500 acres. The gravel roads and remaining trees through the subdivisions where everything started are still red with fire retardant, and only 11 structures have been damaged, at least three of which were homes. Only one evacuation notice is still in place, and fewer than 200 residents remain without power. Incident Commander Bob Albee says the fire is far from over, but it is beginning to wind down, at least in the most populated areas.
We have a bunch of aircraft that are assigned to this fire. We still have resources coming in for this fire, and even though you might see less smoke over the next couple of days, it's not over.
Card Street is still the top priority fire in the nation, but officials don't expect it to keep that distinction for long. Now the challenge is in managing the fire on the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. The entire Skelak Recreation Area has been barricaded, though not totally sealed off, as there are a handful of private homes and boat launches that need to remain accessible. Refuge Fire Management Officer Christy Bullock says this isn't like last year's Funny River Fire. In that one, after residential areas were made safe, the fire was pretty much left alone to burn.
It didn't make sense for firefighter safety to put people out there. There were a lot of reasons not to take direct action on, you know, something that's way out in the wilderness. But this fire is a whole different story.
In the Skelak Lake area, there's a lot of what's called value to protect. It's a really popular recreation spot. Campgrounds, cabins, and really, the forest itself. Hidden Lake, for example, loses a lot of its charm if it's no longer hidden by lush stands of spruce and birch trees.
The refuge manager provides approval for what kind of tactics that can be utilized. And, you know, and that's specifically would be the use of retardant or mechanized equipment. There are challenges of how do you balance trying to stop this fire and maintain, you know, the ecosystem to the best you can. The goal is to stop the fire. There's just too much risk to communities. There's too much risk to the values. The refuge would like this fire stopped.
The two wildfires burning near Cooper Landing aren't posing much of a threat to life and property now. The Juneau Lake fire is approximately 400 acres. It has forced the closure of several trails around Resurrection Pass, and structure protection is in place for some of those trail cabins. The Stetson Creek fire is about 250 acres. It's getting close to some Homer Electric Association transmission lines, but it hasn't caused any outages. As both of those fires work their way uphill, aircraft are the main weapons, though a Type 2 team is now running that show with about 40 firefighters on the ground. Reporting from Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, 10 fin whales die near Kodiak.
it suggests that there's something, maybe a feeding group of fin whales ran into a toxin or a biotoxin.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Baby salmon live here, right in our backyards and neighborhoods. Go out, explore, and take the Baby Salmon Challenge. For more information, go to babysalmon.fish. This announcement is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
When the scandal erupted last year over long wait lists at the Phoenix Veterans Administration, Alaska was found to have quite short wait times. The Alaska VA has for years been buying care for veterans outside the VA at community and private sector clinics, and especially through the Native health care system. It's called Care Closer to Home. That's the model Congress chose when it passed the Veterans Choice Act last year. But as the new choice program spreads across the country and takes hold in Alaska, vets and providers say it's undoing parts of the Alaska-grown system that have worked well. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Demita Duplantis is an Air Force vet and has back pain. She didn't know about the CHOICE program until she got a call from the office of the neurosurgeon she hoped would operate on her back.
They called and told me that they had to cancel my appointment because the VA was doing some kind of new funding thing, and they were not accepting that type of funding that the VA was changing over to.
So Duplantis called the VA. She eventually learned that for an appointment outside the VA, now she has to go through something called the Veterans Choice Program. In Alaska and 27 other states, CHOICE is administered by a company called TriWest. Duplantis says she probably spent 5 hours on the phone bouncing between TriWest and the VA.
The thing that frustrated me, one, my appointment's being canceled, I'm in pain, and two, they changed over this new program and didn't even tell the veterans what they were doing.
Alaska's congressional delegation has received dozens of calls from angry veterans. Vets say clinics they'd been going to aren't accepting CHOICE and that appointments elsewhere are hard or impossible to get. They tell of long hold times to reach TriWest call centers, emails that get no response, and broken links on VA websites. Senator Lisa Murkowski was furious when she learned of the changes in late May.
This is a threat to a collaborative effort that has been built over a period of years that has been very beneficial for our veterans, and we cannot allow the erosion of what we have built to stand.
She fired off a four-alarm letter to the VA secretary. Congressman Don Young sent his own this week, and Senator Dan Sullivan called for a hearing. By late this week, the VA relented in part. They've restored funds for non-Native veterans to get care at Native hospitals and clinics. Andy Tuber, president of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, says last year some 1,400 Alaska vets used their VA benefits to get care at Native health facilities, and most of those vets were non-Natives. Before the VA restored money for tribal providers this week, Tuber says he didn't see the utility of TriWest, the contractor for the CHOICE program. By inserting a private company in the administration of VA care, Tuber says you add a middleman that needs to make a profit.
And it's a wasteful layer of bureaucracy that effectively rations care for the veterans here in Alaska.
Hal Blair, deputy program manager at TriWest, says the company provides an important service or the VA wouldn't have asked the contractor to take on the CHOICE program for much of the country and on short notice.
So we had basically 30 days with our VA partners to go from a blank sheet of paper to having contact centers that could respond to the CHOICE requirements.
Blair says TriWest is working hard to sign up more providers in Alaska. Thanks to a special amendment to the CHOICE Act, they can now pay Alaska providers above the Medicare rate, which should help. Blair says TriWest always aims to be efficient and save the government money.
We like to think of ourselves as taxpayers first, businessmen second, in terms of the way we operate TriWest.
But contracts like this are expensive to administer, especially, Blair says, in their initial phases. A recent Inspector General's report found that for a related contract TriWest has with the VA, the government paid TriWest more than $8 million last year to buy $2 million worth of medical care for veterans. Blair says he hasn't seen the IG report, but he says TriWest's value will become clear once more veterans sign up. In Alaska, the new choice program is baffling for some vets who aren't well equipped to cope with it. Jesse Gottschall of Anchorage was a truck driver in the Army. He served in both Iraq and Afghanistan.
I have a back problem, right? And I need help with it, you know.
He says acupuncture and chiropractic care help him stand up straight so he can work. He also has PTSD and trouble with his memory. Gottschall says it was hard enough to learn the VA system before, and now he feels like he's trying to play chess on a Scrabble board.
I honestly don't know, and that's part of the problem is like I don't know, and I try and figure this stuff out, and I don't know where to call, and you try and talk to somebody, and know you got to do this, you got to do that.
One person who has helped him was his acupuncturist, Valerie DeLon. He says she explained the VA programs and encouraged him to get treatment for his PTSD. DeLon was a TriWest provider. She says she dropped out due to a messy accounting dispute with the company. The Alaska VA director says they're planning a big campaign to explain the choice program to veterans. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
At least 10 Finwheels are dead, having fallen victim to a mysterious affliction that seems to have killed them all near Kodiak Island. Kate Wynn, a marine mammal specialist with the University of Alaska in Kodiak, said all the whales seem to have met their fate at the same time and place.
The evidence suggests that all of these whales that we've found died at about the same time, which is like maybe the third week of May, around the 20th, in a short period of time in a fairly localized area. And that's about all we know right now. So it rules out a couple of things. And the fact that the carcasses are intact, it rules out killer whale predation. But other than that, we're at a loss.
The area the whales were found were all south of Afognak Island, the second largest in the Kodiak Archipelago, just north of Kodiak Island. All the dead whales spotted have been adults, except one calf and a couple of subadults with a mix of genders. It's the feeding that Wynn thinks may be the most likely culprit in their death.
It suggests that there's something maybe a feeding group of fin whales ran into, a toxin or a biotoxin. But there are a lot of things that don't line up with that theory, mainly that we don't find the prey species dead on the beaches or other species that would be eating the same prey dying.
Fin whales, the second largest species after blue whales, are filter feeders, meaning they strain tiny sea life in its baleen to eat. They do not eat larger seafood such as salmon or halibut. Wynn says that a colleague at the Marine Advisory Program in Kodiak is checking for evidence of paralytic shellfish poisoning, blubber and mussel samples, and an eyeball recovered from one whale has been sent for laboratory examination, and Wynn says results might be available next week.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Liz Ruskin. This week on AK, Batmobile. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is stepping up its research on bats in Southeast. The nocturnal bug-eating animal is being threatened in the lower 48 by a disease called white nose syndrome. That's prompting Alaska researchers to find out which bats live here and where they roost. But they can't do all the work by themselves, so they're enlisting the public's help using a mobile bat detector. From member station KHNS, Emily Files has the story.
That's bats. Oh, that's it. Isn't that cool?
The sun has just set, and Pam Randles is driving her car 20 miles per hour along the Chilkoot River.
You drive along very slowly, and you keep a steady pace, and the GPS is keeping track, and then all of a sudden, chitter, 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 and it was just like, whoa, it really worked! You really can hear them!
Now, the human ear can't hear bat sounds, so Randles' car has been turned into a Batmobile. There's an ultrasonic microphone attached to the top of the car and a little box inside that records the bat calls. A GPS pinpoints the location of the sounds. Michael Cohen is a biologist with Fish and Game and one of the researchers on the bat study.
I mean, it's a huge project. We couldn't do it without citizen scientists.
The research started in 2011, but last year they ramped up their efforts by getting citizen scientists involved in acoustic driving surveys.
Anybody can go out and record bat calls. We have a certain route that we're interested in being able to see what bat species are on that route and where they are. And people will go out at night and record bat calls as they drive.
Cohen says last summer the surveys were hugely successful in the first two communities, Haines and Gustavus. 30 volunteers participated. This summer, Cohen expanded the program to Juneau, Craig, Petersburg, Wrangell, and Sitka. In Haines, the library has the sign-up sheet for the bat detectors. But when the people collecting data are not scientists, can you trust them?
The way that our research project is orientated is that we are asking specific information from citizen scientists, and so it really provides no room for failure.
You just put the microphone on your car, turn on the microphone and GPS, and drive. Cohen says they've identified four bat species in Haines and Gustavus. They include silver-haired bats, little brown bats, and California bats. Getting a sense of bat activity here gives scientists a baseline in case the disease white nose syndrome spreads to Alaska. Since 2006, scientists estimate 80% of the bat population in the northeastern U.S. died from white nose syndrome.
It is a threat to bats right now, a big threat to bats. And so scientists, bat scientists as a whole, are trying to come up with a way to monitor the population of bats on a North America-wide effort. And so that's why these driving surveys and the stationary detectors are useful. We can use the information and send that information to this huge database to be able to monitor bat populations.
So scientists are clearly concerned about bats. But how do you make the average person care about them?
I try to incorporate the importance of bats in the way that bats can eat mosquitoes. So they're voracious mosquito eaters. A single little brown bat, which is the size of your thumb, can eat 1,000 mosquitoes in an hour.
Apparently, that pitch has worked. The success of this citizen science project is prompting Fish and Game to expand public involvement. Next summer, they're hoping to use citizen scientists in amphibian research. Back in the Batmobile with Randles, it's been a fairly quiet night. We've heard about five bat calls between Chilkoot Lake and the end of Mud Bay Road. Randles says before this, she actually wasn't a big fan of bats. But her perspective has changed.
Then when I come out here to study these guys, you know, it's all of a sudden I'm not hating bats for no reason. You know, I have a better appreciation for what they do and how they fit into the system and what the benefits of having them around are.
And besides, she says, they're just so cute sounding. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Aideen Fullerton, a Willow resident who evacuated her home on Monday because of the Sockeye fire. Aideen left with 3 kids, 5 dogs, 2 cats, and a hamster. She had to leave behind 3 tarantulas. When we talked to her, she had just discovered her home was spared, along with the spiders.
My son is there right now. Not only the tarantulas there, but all my windows are, so the burglars haven't got me either. People are being so great. One man even drove up and says, "Oh, you have kids and dogs. I have a cabin in Big Lake. I'll move out to my bus. Do you want to stay here?" I said, "Thank you, but no, I wouldn't bring 5 dogs to someone's house." And these people have been so great. They even brought me bedding for my son's hamster. There's stacks of kennels everywhere. They say, take them, keep them, wash them, return them, whatever you want to do. Behind the building, they have a big bucket of leashes, collars, tie downs. They brought him a brush to brush his dog, because in this heat, one of them started shedding terribly. They brought him a brushing. I mean, how can people be so nice? I started taking foster kids when I was 24. Mm-hmm. I have raised so many of them, and the last couple of years, I was done. My New Year's resolution was to do nothing for anybody, stop loving people. I think I'm not going to go with that now.
Aideen Fullerton evacuated from her home in Willow because of the sockeye fire. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Files, Ellen Lockyer, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Liz Ruskin.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Houston, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, and Jay Barrett in Kodiak. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.